This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Once again, Donald Trump decides to retroactively change what he said. We'll talk about that now on Tactics. Good morning. Welcome to Tactics. You're listening to us on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, that's the way to get in touch with us. If you have a desire to do so, you're always welcome to. 860-1440 is the way to do that. You're also welcome to tweet us at Tactics Radio if you want to do that as well. We always welcome that, of course. And you're always welcome to get in touch with us on Facebook as well, facebook.com/tacticsradio. So there is no shortage. There is no excuse. If you want to comment on the program, if you want to comment on what we are talking about, whatever day it is, you have no excuse. There are plenty of avenues to do so. That being said, welcome into the program. I'm Caleb Colquitt. As always, it is a pleasure to be with you. So the other day, you may recall that we were covering a issue where Donald Trump, in his press conference, the one that he did with Vladimir Putin, he was talking about whether or not he trusts the intelligence agencies or he trusts Vladimir Putin more. And essentially, he said, I don't know why Russia would be behind it. In other words, saying, I don't know why they would be behind all of the meddling with the election, and then retroactively comes back and says, well, I meant to say wouldn't, and wouldn't changes the whole thing. What I meant to say was, well, I wouldn't know why Russia wouldn't be behind it. Sort of a double negative there, and that's the president, not me. And so what Donald Trump was trying to do is retroactively say the opposite of what he said. But part of the reason that I didn't buy this is if you watch that entire clip and watch it in its context and watch the entire press release that he said there, he winds up actually kind of walking back the walk back. So he says that he trusts the conclusion that the intelligence community reached, but he also says, well, it could be Russia and it could be others. Well, if the conclusion that the intelligence community reached was that when it came to all of this, that the conclusion that they reached was that it was Russia and they were the ones meddling in the election, and then Donald Trump comes back and says, oh, I trust the intelligence community and I trust their conclusion that Russia meddled, and then 12 seconds later says, well, you know, but it could be other people. Well, then you don't agree with the conclusion. If the conclusion was it was Russia and you're saying, well, it could be Russia, it could be other people, then you don't agree with the conclusion. You're saying the opposite of what the conclusion said. And so Donald Trump kind of saying that, okay, well, I made a mistake there. And again, this is part of the reason why I said yesterday, I don't really buy the idea that he meant why wouldn't Russia be behind it. I don't buy that he made a mistake there. I think that he said exactly what he thought in the press conference, and he decided to walk it back during this latest press conference where he was correcting the mistake of the other one. And I also believe, because of that and because of everything surrounding that, that that was the case. But I also said, and I stick to this as well, that there is a silver lining that Donald Trump, at least in his self-reflection, looked back at that and said, yeah, I probably shouldn't have said that. Which to me shows at least a glimmer that Donald Trump is listening to his advisors, that he decided not to necessarily double down on it. And it was a very unconvincing walk back, but at least he felt the need to issue it nonetheless. That to me does at least show some self-reflection that he may not have said what he said may not have been the best thing to do. Well, today we have yet another kind of half-hearted walk back on that. The other day he was being asked in a press conference by a reporter whether or not he believed that Russian meddling, Russian tampering, the Russians trying to get involved in our elections was still going on, and he said no. And then what they did later is they said, and this was Sarah Huckabee Sanders trying to explain this and shed some light on it, she said, well, what he was saying no to was no, no more questions. There's only one really big problem with that, is that he was answering questions just a couple minutes later in that same press conference. So if he was saying no more questions, then why did he answer questions directly after that? And furthermore, Donald Trump is not a guy known for short answers. I mean, he gives them at least occasionally, but usually what he does is he explains himself and he never misses an opportunity to take a jab at the press. And so if he was really saying no more questions, Donald Trump strikes me as more of the person that would do what he did the other day with CNN when he was in Britain, which is to say, nope, no more questions. You're fake news. I don't take questions from fake news. That to me would be a little more convincing if we were trying to figure out whether he was saying no more questions or no, he believed that Russia was no longer meddling. I think that he actually meant that Russia was no longer involving themselves in our elections. Based on the context, based on the press conference, that's what I believe is what happened here. But here's the thing, and this is really where it all culminates. I believe that that's the case, and I believe that Donald Trump has this weird blind spot when it comes to Russia that seems to be, it's almost as though it cannot be understood or explained. But, well, I say that. I actually do have a pretty good explanation of it, and I think that it all goes back to, and this is the key to really understanding anything that the president does, which is it all goes back to his ego. And that is the only reliable gauge, I guess you would say, as to explaining his behavior or why Donald Trump does what he does. And so because of that, I think that there is a pretty decent way to explain why he's doing this. I think that it has to do with the media constantly attacking him and saying that Russian collusion, and they're trying to tie that with Russia involving themselves in the election. And if they did involve themselves in the election, it's only to help President Trump because he feels that that is an attack against his legitimacy as president. He likes to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say that there is absolutely no Russian involvement in the election whatsoever, even though that flies directly in the face of the findings of his own intelligence agencies. But all that being said, all this hullabaloo, all this being worked up, there's a story from CNN this morning that I think perfectly encapsulates the entire issue. And that is, and this is a headline, keep in mind, directly from CNN, not exactly Trump's biggest cheerleading section, to say the least. Headline, U.S. officials say allies discounting Trump-Putin summit as meaningless. And that really does say it all. You can read into some of the article itself, and it's a good article. I posted it on Tactics at Tactics Radio. But there is one official that they cite, and let me see if I can find it right now. This is an unnamed, but according to the article, a Western ally. He's an official, and he's one of the big wigs in one of our NATO allies. And he said, the summit itself was meaningless, the official said. It's being discounted. The official's comments echoed that of a Western diplomat who predicted that any comments by Trump that Trump made to Putin at the summit would not lead to any tangible changes in U.S. policy toward Russia. The diplomat who called Trump's performance at the press conference with Putin pathetic and devastating said, one silver lining is that nothing will come out of this summit because Trump never follows through on what comes out of these meetings with world leaders. The same Western official goes on to say, Putin probably thinks the whole thing was a joke. Even if he wanted to get something from Trump, it never goes anywhere. And it doesn't, and he doesn't know anything of substance, talking about Putin there. So even if you accept the strategy, how does he negotiate? All right, so this is all going back to essentially the exact same thing that I said. And CNN is reporting on this. Which is, when it comes to our Western allies, when it comes to the people in NATO, the people that this most affects, the people that would most be threatened by a powerful Russia, they're not worried about it because they look at the summit, they look at what Trump says, and they go, look, Trump has already said stuff like this. We already know Trump has a weird blind spot and a weird affection for Russia. Yeah, it's strange, but does it ever actually manifest itself in policy? It hasn't yet, and we've been doing this for almost 2 years now, year and a half. And that being said, that's exactly what I said yesterday. The Western diplomats are actually getting exactly the same thing out of the summit that I did, which is, yeah, it's weird. Yeah, it bothers me. Yeah, I wish that Trump wouldn't do it, but does it actually amount to a policy change? The answer is no. When Trump said the other day that I have been tougher on Russia than any other president. Now, that's a bit much if you consider guys like Reagan. But if you're talking about George W. Bush, if you're talking about President Barack Obama, H.W. Bush, Clinton, if you're looking at the actual policy, yeah, he's right. If you're talking about his language, no. But if you're looking at his actual policy and the difference that it makes in the State Department, in the when it comes to the military, if you're looking at his policy and this White House's policy on Russia, it has been stronger than any president since Ronald Reagan. Reagan's was a little stronger, but my point in all this is the Western diplomats, the people that it most affect and have most skin in the game when it comes to this, they're not worried. And if that's the case, I got to believe that I shouldn't be all that worried about it either. All right, 860-1440, we have a special guest coming up in just a second. Scott Tribble, the general manager for the Biscuits, is coming up in just a moment. We'll be back with him.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440, that is the number if you want to weigh in. And if you're wondering about the music and why that is taking the place of our normal return, that is because we have a guest in studio right now. The general manager for the Biscuits, Scott Tribble, is with us. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
Hey, so what's going on?
We got baseball. First place biscuits going on. So we've got games tonight through Sunday. It's a big weekend. We had our bucket hat giveaway supporting our military with some nice little Army Ranger style bucket hats, and we're hugely popular. So we're going to do it again tonight and give away a free t-shirt. We're going to have some first responders out on Friday night with Max Fireworks. We got our world famous Millennial Night on Saturday with more Max Fireworks, and giving away a Big Mo growth chart on Sunday, presented by Baptist Health. All the kids are coming out on Sunday. So lots of fun Biscuits baseball coming up.
Yeah, that's one thing I actually really like about your Sunday games is that usually the themes, and of course you always have the, the Coca-Cola Kids Run the Bases?
Yeah, pregame catch on the field, postgame Coke Kids Run the Bases. It's every Sunday's Bark in the Park, so even if you don't have kids and you have a puppy, you can bring the puppy out. So there's something for everybody on Sunday games. It's like a nice Sunday afternoon. Downtown Montgomery at the ballpark. No better way to beat it.
Well, you know, Sundays are very busy for me because, of course, I got a Bible class to teach and I've got church every Sunday, but I really do need to make it out to the ballpark. I need to time it. I'll probably have to leave a little early for evening worship, but I need to head over to the ballpark on Sundays. Very family oriented on the Sunday games.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a kind of a ritual for a lot of people. You know, when they go to morning service, they'll go to brunch or lunch and then they'll come out to the Biscuits game after that. Or if you got evening service, come to the game, then go to evening service afterwards.
But yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely not to where you can you can't go to church and go to the game as well. I know I've done that several times, and I've always made it just fine. I have to leave a little early sometimes, but I mean it's still great to get to see some baseball. Now I got to ask about this with the first responders. What all are you doing for the first responders night?
So we're working with Montgomery, Prattville, a bunch of different local communities, and getting their first responders out. So we're going to have police, fire rescue, communications, EMA, all the types of different folks out there. We're actually landing a helicopter on the field before the game
cool.
to deliver our special guest Friday night. So the Haynes Ambulance will be landing a helicopter in center field. We're going to have recruitment stations set up so you can learn about, you know, what it takes to become a Montgomery police officer. We're going to have different appreciation events and recognition on field for, you know, award winners and officers of the year, firefighters of the year, things like that. So it's going to be a really cool night. We're working with City Hall and Department of Public Safety to put together some really cool stuff. So it should be a fun night. Come out, show your support, whether blue or red. Again, there's going to be a lot of stuff going on. We even have some specialty burgers. We got a Blue Bloods burger
Ooh.
And a Firehouse burger that'll have some jalapenos and sriracha mayo and things like that on it. So,
ooh, that does sound good.
It's going to be a fun night. And again, come out, show your support for those who keep it safe here at home.
Well, and you know I'm a burger connoisseur, so that's definitely a draw for me. But But yeah, I just love the fact that y'all have always been good stewards of the community. You really care about this community, and I think that the First Responders Night really shows that, because as I've always told people, because I run into some people that are not big baseball fans, and because of that, they never even really consider going to a Biscuits game. And yeah, I tell them, it's like, look, these guys, they care about the city of Montgomery. They care about the community, and there's so much more to it than just baseball. There's so many things that you can be entertained with, even if you're not a baseball fan. So yeah, I recommend everybody go out and see this and really support our first responders.
Less than 10% of the people who come to our game come just to watch baseball. You know, they're coming for the Max fireworks. They're coming for the food. They're coming to hang out with friends. I mean, it's
ooh, I aimed the 10%. That makes
Caleb sits up there and watches the guys literally wants to get to know them. But again, the guys who sit there and keep score and know every player and know their stats, they're few and far between. We have people who come to our games who don't even know the final score of the game. I want you to be involved. I want you to know, because we are in first place, and we do have some great players on our team right now. But as long as you're coming out and having fun, that's all we care about. And like you said, you know, supporting our community that supports us, it's big to us. That's why we do our military appreciation nights, mm-hmm, and first responders nights, and Grantham school nights, family faith nights, whatever it may be. Anything we can do to make it fun for the community and give them a special night out.
Well, speaking of fun for the community, we got to talk about Millennial Night.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, this thing, and we were talking about this a little bit in the break. I loved it. If nothing else, it gave me an excuse to have a little fun on Twitter, because the responses on Twitter were just ridiculous.
Conversation starters. That's what we are. We're conversation starters.
So y'all didn't really expect to like be in USA Today with all this, did you?
Oh, every tweet we put out, we expect to be in. No. Absolutely
not. Do y'all have a back channel I don't know about?
We go viral for something about once a year, it seems like. A couple years ago, the San Diego Chargers moved to Los Angeles, and they came out with this logo where it was just an L and A and a little lightning bolt. So we made fun of it by putting a lightning bolt on our Biscuits logo, uh-huh, and it was our most viewed tweet of all time. It was just something we put together in 20 seconds, and it blew up. This is the same thing.
Yeah.
This is
social media squirrely like that. You never
Millennial
know.
Night has been on our schedule since January. It's been in our pocket schedule. You probably have in your wallet right now.
I do.
Like our magnet schedules that hang around your office or your refrigerator. It's been on there all year long, and then we finally promoted it on social media, and one person with, I think, 500,000 followers said, huh, this is interesting. And the next thing we knew, we had 500,000 impressions and views on our tweet, and getting emails and not actually, sorry, we didn't get any emails. We got a lot of social media posts because no one wanted to actually put their name behind something other than just, oh, this isn't a good idea or whatnot. But a lot of backlash, but honestly, still way more likes than there were people with negative comments.
Well, see, and that's what I noted. I was looking at the numbers, and these are the numbers from a week ago, so I'm sure that it's grown since then. But I was looking at the numbers. I was like, okay, this thing has about 450 comments,
yeah,
and about 75% of those, maybe, you know, a little bit less, are negative. But it has 1,000 tweets, and I said, so doing some quick mental math, you can tell that it's got about four times the amount of likes that it does negative comments.
Yeah, Twitter ratio. As long as you have more likes than you do retweets and replies, you're okay, and our Twitter ratio is good. So, yeah.
But now I'm going to say this, because you know that in this community especially, I have a reputation of holding people's feet to the fire, sure, holding them accountable. It's just who I am, and I'm going to do that with y'all.
Sure.
Y'all better deliver on the avocados. Like,
it's going to be there.
I definitely want
some. We've already got the napping station set up. We've got the avocados in-house. We're going to have avocado burgers. We're going to do some avocado toast. So it's going to be the one thing. We're also doing craft beer specials.
Ooh.
So again, like everyone talks about, like we're trying to make fun of millennials. That's not what we're doing. We're highlighting the millennial generation. We're not singling out people. It's like 80s night. Not every person in the 80s wore sideways ponytails and leg warmers and wristbands. But that's what you see when you go to
an
80s
my history
night.
Book is filled with lies. No, I'm kidding.
But that's what it's like, an 80s night or a 90s night.
Right.
It's a millennial
it's,
night.
It's
We're
really
not saying
no big deal.
Millennials are lazy. We've never said that. I mean,
well, see, the
I'm
tweet didn't even say that. Yeah. They inferred that, but that's not what y'all
said.
We said,
do you like free stuff without having to do a lot of work? Find me anybody, millennial or not, who doesn't like free stuff. We're giving a T-shirt away tonight. It's free. All you got to do is show up to the game.
No, I thought it was a brilliant idea. I thought it was hilarious. And one of the things, and this was kind of the final message that I gave, because we spent, like, I think about an hour on this. Literally an hour on this last week. I said, look, you got to be able to laugh at yourself.
Yeah.
You got to be able to have fun.
Absolutely.
At your own expense. And if you can't do that, you're going to have a very difficult life just going through not being able to laugh at yourself.
We're a minor league baseball team. We don't take ourselves too seriously. Our name is the Biscuits. There's a team
I was about to say. New York
who's calling themselves the Pizza Rats. There's a team over in Georgia who are wearing kilts for a game. Like, it's minor league baseball. It's all about fun. We're not trying to make political statements or social statements or things like that. It's all about fun, family atmosphere, and that's what we were doing with this night. And again, majority of people have really liked it. And I think if you come out to the game Saturday, you're going to have a good time.
That's the thing. Most of the people liked it. I think a lot of the people there are going to like it. I tell you, this is one thing I'm going to go out, if nothing else, just to get the avocado burgers, because I am a fan of avocado. But anyway, and burgers. All right. Well, thank you very much, Scott. No, always great. There's a full weekend with the series against the Mississippi Braves, so be sure to check that out. If you're a Braves fan like I am, one of the reasons you're going out there is to check out the talent that may be up in Atlanta before too
tomorrow
long.
Night on Friday, Kyle Wright is one of their top pitching prospects. He'll be pitching against us on Friday.
All right, all good stuff. Thanks so much, Scott. Appreciate it.
Thanks,
all right, we'll be back in just a moment.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt every weekday from 9 to 11 only on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com.
Colossians 3:17. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through him to God the Father.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440, that is the way to get in touch with us. If you have a desire to do so, you're welcome to do that. And it is funny, because we were just talking to Scott Tribble, the general manager of the Montgomery Biscuits. We were just talking about Millennial Night, and I think that it's going to be a great event. I'm going to be there if you want to check that out. I know that I meet a lot of fans. I actually probably meet more fans at the Biscuits game than I do anywhere else. I'm not sure why exactly that is. Maybe it's because I'm a recluse and I just don't go out into public all that often. So the Biscuits are one of the few places that I will actually go out into public. Maybe that's it. I don't really know. But my point in all of that is, it's one of the few places that I actually will go out and meet a lot of people. So if you want to meet me, if you want to talk to me, we can talk some politics. You can do that right now if you want to. 860-1440 would be the way to do that and to get in touch with me. But it's funny that Scott Tribble and I were talking about Millennial Night, which is going to be this Saturday, which I will be at. And one of my top stories today is about a millennial herself. Now, this interview, I think, actually is 2 or 3 days old. The reason that I'm going back to it, though, is I think that it is a perfect example of actually part of the reason that I think that there are some issues with the millennial generation. And keep in mind, I say this as a millennial. But there, and this is more of a problem with young people across the generations, but I think with millennials especially, there's an issue here because we don't have the same aversion, and statistics and studies and public opinion polls from Pew and Rasmussen have both backed this up. We don't have the same aversion to socialism that we did, and which is, I think a lot of it has to do with we didn't have to fight it. Because you look at previous generations, either they did fight it themselves or they lived through at least a part of the Cold War. They remember the evil that was coming out of the Soviet Union. They remember the horrors that were put upon them by big, powerful, authoritarian governments that used their top-down authority and usually did so in the name of communism or socialism. And so now it has become fashionable again to refer to yourself as a democratic socialist. There is a large swath of Democrats, large swath of millennials. There's also a large swath of Democrats, but there is a large swath of millennials who do not believe that socialism in and of itself is a bad thing or a thing to be feared. And because of that, we're having to deal with people in my generation that are actually pushing this. And this young lady is no exception. Her name is, I think, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is the way to say it. I think that's the correct way. And so she makes a few ignorant comments, and we're going to talk about some of the implications of that. She was doing this interview with PBS, and I did want to play just a couple of pieces from this interview. This is her talking about Israel.
But I am, of course, the dynamic there in terms of geopolitics
of
and the
course
war in the Middle East is very different than people expressing their First Amendment right to protest.
Well, yes, but I also think that what people are starting to see, at least in the occupation of Palestine, is just an increasing crisis of humanitarian condition. And that to me is just where I tend to come from on this issue.
You use the term the occupation of Palestine. What did you mean by that?
I think what I meant is like the settlements that are increasing in some of these areas and places where Palestinians are experiencing difficulty in access to their housing and homes.
Do you think you can expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd also just, I am not the expert on geopolitics on this issue.
Boy, that's an understatement. There's really only one way to describe this particular soundbite, and I'm going to be as gentle as I think humanly possible on this.
Wrong!
I really think that's about the perfect way to describe it. I mean, there's no other way to say it. This was a massive bomb dropped by her. And here's what I think is really funny about this. She ends this clip and ends this incredibly stupid statement by saying that she is not the expert when it comes to geopolitical when it comes to the geopolitics of the whole thing. Here's the thing. She has a degree in international relations. Let me say that again. She has a degree in international relations. That is her specialty. And so I can accept somebody who is new to politics like she is, who has never held office before, that has not studied these issues, that maybe comes from a business background or has a degree in something completely different, saying, well, you know, I'm not the expert when it comes to foreign relations. It's an area that I'm not particularly well-versed in. But here's the problem with that. First of all, that excuse shouldn't work with her because this is what her specialty is supposed to be in. And on top of that, she just made a bold statement about her stance on the issue and then revealed that that stance doesn't come from anywhere, that she really doesn't know anything about the issue. In fact, when she's saying the settlements are increasing, yeah, the settlements are increasing. There are Palestinians that have never lived in Israel or lived in the areas that are quote-unquote contested, that are just straight-up moving into Israel's land. So the exact opposite of what she's talking about is happening. I mean, if you don't even understand the basics of the Six Days War and how that shook out and what happened and the fact that Israel has owned that land for a very long time, because if the idea is Israel didn't get that land fairly because they took it in a war, first of all, they were not the aggressors in that war, and they gave most of the land that they got in that war back to the people that it originally belonged to. The only exception to that was the West Bank, and a large part of that was because that was important territory to them. They gave back the vast majority of the land that they had actually taken. They could have taken a lot more land and had control of it at the time. And they voluntarily gave it back to the Muslim countries that had attacked them in the war. But instead of keeping it, they gave most of it back. They said, we'll just take the West Bank. And that has been in place since the 1960s. And if we're just going to retroactively say, well, if you got it through warfare, then you have to give it back, even if it was a defensive war, then literally every country in the world, you would have to go back to, like, I don't even know how far you could go back. It would have to be basically Bible time borders. I mean, you look at the War of the Roses in England, you look at the Revolutionary War here in America. If gaining territory through warfare now is null and void and we have to go back to the former borders, then there isn't a country that stands in the world today that would still have the borders that it did, and the vast majority of them would not exist if we're going back to as far back as we can in history. And, you know, if you go back further than that, then there you'd have to go all the way back to the days of Noah, I guess, which would mean there were no countries. But nonetheless, you're looking at all this, it's just so ignorant, and she admits that she really has no idea what the heck she's talking about. So this is really, I think, a perfect example of the value of a liberal education. Because she paid no telling how much money to get that education, to get that degree in international relations, and she cannot even explain the very basics of what is going on in the Middle East or the history of it. Now, I'm not an expert in that area either. I consider foreign relations to be the area that I am weakest in, but the difference is I'm a communication major and I tend to specialize in local politics, economics, that kind of thing. And even I have a better working knowledge of this stuff than her, who has an actual degree in foreign relations. And I really do think that what this all comes back to is she believed that her answer was a passable answer. In other words, she just said the occupation of Palestine, because she has never been challenged on these ideas. Never. Because what has happened in her own liberal circles and at her own liberal-run university where she went, what has happened there is every time she just said, occupy Palestine, occupation of Palestine, Israel is occupying Palestine, every time she's ever said that before, whether it was someone in her inner circle, whether it was someone in the media, whether it were some of her Democrat socialist friends, all they've done is nod along and go, yep. Yep, that makes sense. Yep. They've never asked her to actually explain that. They've never asked her to elaborate on it. They've never asked her to tell why it is that Israel is in the wrong when it comes to that. And so this reporter, and props to PBS for pressing her on it and asking her what exactly she meant by that and not letting her get away with having this pad Democrat answer, which is, well, Israel is always the bad guy and that's just the way that it is. You can't just shout occupation of Palestine and act like you're all of a sudden an expert and you have a reason for your strong stance on this. And this reporter with PBS, I thought, did a great job of asking her that question and sorting that out. So, you know, like I said, all props to PBS on that. But that's the thing. She has never been challenged on this idea before, and that is why she was taken completely blindsided by this. Must be nice. Because when you're in the media in this capacity, when you're like this and you live in this little bubble and the media never presses you or asks you to explain your ideas, it makes you like this to where you've never actually thought out and rationalized your own stances and your own beliefs. With a conservative, if you've spent any time in the public eye, any time in the media, you have to do that constantly because everything out of your mouth is met with suspicion. And they want to flesh it out, which is actually, I think, a good thing. I just wish that they did the same thing with Little Miss Democratic Socialism a little more often. And I thought that this was a really good, very telling interview with the fact that she is someone who is highly educated, but does not have a, you know, highly educated in the sense that she has the paper and the diploma, but not somebody that has actually had her ideas challenged or had to flesh out why she has the stances that she does. There's another clip from this that we're going to play where she talks about socialism versus capitalism, which I really want to get to. 860-1440. We'll be back in just a second.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
There must be religion. When that ligament is torn, society is disjointed and its members perish. The most important of all lessons is the denunciation of ruin to every state that rejects the precepts of religion. Governor Morris, signer of the Constitution.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440, that's the way to get in touch with us. Also, at Tactics Radio, if you want to tweet, we sometimes read our tweets on the air, so we're always happy to do that. 860-1440, if you do want to weigh in, those numbers once again. Now, we were talking about this interview that was done with PBS with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I think is the way to say her name. I'm probably butchering that. I will say this just out of the gate. Can we get rid of the double last names? And this has nothing to do with her being a Democrat. I'm the same way with Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Just decide on one. You can be Sarah Huckabee, you can be Sarah Sanders, but just for the sake of everybody else, please limit it to just one. Just go by one. I'm not saying you have to legally get rid of it, but just pick one to go by. And I would say the same thing to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Just pick Ocasio or Cortez. I don't care which one, just pick one. But anyway, I won't go on another rant about that. All right, let's go ahead and listen to, because there is another clip from her in this PBS interview. Keep in mind, she is a open Democrat socialist, so she is in the same line with Bernie Sanders. She unseated a very powerful, long-standing incumbent in the Democrat primary in New York this time. And so this lady, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, this is some of her stances on the economy and on capitalism versus socialism.
No, the benefit of capitalism is that you engage in voluntary trade, mm-hmm. and that because it creates value, mm-hmm. it is the system that, unlike all the others, has lifted more people out of poverty mm-hmm. over the course of human history than any other system.
Truth.
Well, so I think that those things that you talk about, that you discuss, are part of the course of human evolution. And so I would hope that the most recent economic system, our current economic system, is the one that is most beneficial for everyday people. But what we're also starting to see is that, first of all, I think that when we talk about socialist or democrat, especially democratically socialist economies, mm-hmm. first of all, they're done with the full input of everybody. You vote. It's
right,
it's
like Venezuela.
Democratic. So if it's something is not a good idea, it doesn't get voted for, ideally. And the other thing, too, is that we're starting to see that the people who create value in society are not experiencing any portion of the value that they are creating. And so I do think that, absolutely, capitalism was the most efficient and best economy, perhaps, for the time that it was at, perhaps. But as we evolve, as automation begins to really take out extremely large industries, we need to say that we're not going to throw those people away.
So in the context of democratic socialism, then, do you think it calls for an end to capitalism?
Ultimately, we are marching towards progress on this issue. I do think that we are going to see an evolution in our economic system of an unprecedented degree. And it's hard to say what direction that takes. You know, I joke
that. You're skeptical that capitalism is going to continue to be the right answer.
Yeah, I think it's at least a question. I think it's absolutely a question.
Okay, so a lot to unpack in that little 2-minute clip, but I would like to go ahead and start with this idea of democratic socialism. Well, what makes democratic socialism better than regular socialism is that it's democratic, which means that the people aren't going to vote for things that are bad. Bad ideas won't get through. Has she never read about any democracy in history? That's how it always freaking happens every single time. This is part of the reason that James Madison in Federalist 10 talked about democracy as being a bad thing. Democracy is not good. Democracy always leads to a big government state that is tyrannical. You don't understand. Tyranny of the majority is just as bad, sometimes worse, than tyranny of a monarch. And this is what he observed when researching ancient Greece. James Madison understood that eventually, once 51% of the population realizes that they can take rights away from the other 49%, they will always do so. And that's exactly what you're seeing. Let's look at democratic socialism. Democratic socialism was the moniker under which Hugo Chavez took over Venezuela. He basically instituted democracy, the democracy voted for socialism, and they voted to make him a dictator, and that's what happened. And that's the reason Venezuela right now, even though it's one of the most resource-rich nations in the world, they're having people wait in line for 3 hours to get one can of beans to feed their family for that night. They're waiting in line for toilet paper. Their hospitals don't even have diapers and formula. And they're having the average Venezuelan has lost over 20 pounds in the past year, and they're having children literally die in the hospital from malnutrition because the hospitals don't even have formula to feed them. That's democratic socialism when taken to its logical conclusion. And do you know who coined the phrase democratic socialism? Lenin. Lenin is the guy who, whenever people would call him a Marxist or call him a communist, he would say, no, I'm a democratic socialist. Look all this stuff up. It was Lenin that coined the phrase democratic socialism, and we all know how that ended. I mean, with the USSR. So the idea that because it's democratic, oh, people aren't going to vote for bad ideas, that is laughably naive. People vote for bad ideas all the time. And in fact, she is a testament to that. that people will vote for a bad candidate or bad ideas. But anyway, that being said, looking at this, the end part of her statement there, where she is talking about this, she says that, well, capitalism isn't the answer because human evolution is going to basically mean that there is going to be a progression there. We're going to progress past capitalism. That is word for word out of Marx. That was Marx's core belief, that capitalism was a evolution out of the monarchy, and eventually capitalism would give way and progress would happen. That's what it means to be a progressive. You believe that humankind is going to progress past capitalism, past the Constitution, so on and so forth. And so the idea that she's not a dyed-in-the-wool Marxist is completely betrayed by the fact that she's essentially quoting Marx directly out of this. And, I mean, it shows her true colors. We'll be back. Hour 2 is coming up next.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
More idiocy from the left, as always, not only with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but also with our former president. We get to all that this hour on Tactics. Yep, just one more day, and then it's Friday. We can all relax. Welcome back to the program. You are in the Situation Room for Hour 2 of Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. And I'm going to do something a little unusual. I usually do not take calls in my opening monologue, but considering there would be no monologue and y'all would be getting a best of this morning if it were not for this man driving me to work this morning since my truck is in the shop, we're going to go to him right now. Let's go to John from Millbrook on line one.
Good morning. Yeah, I wanted to address the issue from last hour with Ms. Cortez. I'll tell you what she knew. Not what she didn't know and what she didn't realize, but what she knew. First of all, she knew the team that she was supposed to defend was Palestine.
Right.
She didn't know any actual facts about it or the situation at all. She just knows, okay, Palestine's on our side. That's who I need to defend. Another thing she knew was that a catchword that is so important among liberals is she had to use the word humanitarian.
Mm.
Being concerned about that, it has to be a humanitarian kind of thing, even if it doesn't mean anything. And so what she continued to do was to really to talk in circles, and you could tell that she didn't know what she was talking about when she got into that. But she reverted back to the smoldy, oldy, good, the important phrases and words that you have to use if you're a socialist. So as a result of that, that's what she knew, and that's the only thing she had in her background that could help her. It wasn't any actual knowledge about the issue at all, which is also important for a lot of socialists like that.
You know, John from Millbrook, I know that one of your favorite movies is Patch Adams.
Yeah.
Great movie, Robin Williams, and I mean, just a phenomenal movie if you haven't seen it. And he plays a doctor, and he's a very unconventional doctor, for those of you who may not have seen the film. And one of the things he tries to do is he tries to get people to talk to him, to tell them about themselves, to tell them about our life. Very personable character. And one of the things that he talks about is program responses. You remember that?
Yeah.
And so what he's trying to do is he said he wants to see if he can change the programmed response by changing some of the parameters around which the program response is. So what he's talking about there is if someone says to you, hi, on the street, you're programmed to automatically, because it's the socially acceptable thing to do, to respond with hi. You don't think about it. It's just what you do because it's a programmed response. That's what a programmed response is. That's exactly what is going on here. All she knows is when she hears Israel, when she hears that issue come up, she knows that she's supposed to say occupation of Palestine, and she's supposed to say humanitarian.
Right.
And as long as she says that, most of her buddies in the media and just about anybody on the left is just going to nod and go along with it.
Because that's what they know, too.
Right.
And that's all they know.
But when she ran up against somebody that was actually interested in hearing her ideas on the subject, it was revealed that she didn't actually have any ideas on the subject. At least none of her own.
As a politician, she's going to learn the best thing to do in instances like that is not to say anything.
Yeah, well, that's the thing.
To say, I don't know. Is the better answer.
Ms. Cortez is a 28-year-old, very well-educated, very attractive young lady. Mm-hmm. And because of that, she has been used to getting away with, if she didn't know something, she can just kind of giggle and say, well, I'm not the expert.
Right.
But that's not going to work in the political realm. At least, I mean, it may work with the people in New York because they happen to share her political alliance. But if she gets on to the actual big stage, that's not going to convince anybody. People aren't just going to accept the fact that you don't know anything if you're supposed to be a member of the House Intelligence Committee or one of these other committees that she may sit on. People aren't just going to accept that and be like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
But watch this, though. The liberals, when they hear that, they're still going to make her out to be brilliant, a genius.
Oh, of course they will. They have to do that.
Because, and if it were somebody conservative that was that clueless about it, of course they would be tarred and feathered politically anyway.
Well, I'll throw this scenario at you and see what your reaction is, because I think it's probably going to be the same as mine, but I'm interested to hear if it will be. What if there was a very attractive person that had just unseated a very popular Republican for their nomination to the House to be elected as the nominee for their party? Let's say that had happened and the exact same interview happens on PBS and it's a Republican and they give essentially the same thing and say, well, I really don't have any idea when it comes to foreign relations. How do you think the media would have reacted to that?
Oh, yeah, you know what they would do.
What would they say about her?
Well, they would say it was stupid.
Yeah.
Didn't do research, doesn't care about the people or the mm-hmm. issue, has no concern for them at all. That's just all he's worried about is his own elitist white people, if that were that person. You know, it would be the same kind of tactics would be used that they're using right now on people.
Well, the thing is, we don't even really have to imagine that because we know what it would be like if it were a very attractive conservative woman, somebody like Sarah Palin, Michelle Bachmann, because we've seen them happen. They referred to her as a bimbo. They said, well, she only got elected because she's pretty. See, they would never say that about somebody like Ms. Cortez.
No.
But
you're right.
You know, when it's Sarah Palin and she says something dumb, they say, see, she only got elected because she's pretty.
I'll tell you why she was elected, actually. It was because she outworked the other guy.
Probably so. I mean, I didn't follow her. Go ahead.
I'd say to her credit, she did. From what I understand and some investigation done about that election, mm-hmm. she just outworked it. And she was attractive. And she was personable to a great degree. And plus, she said the right key words that New Yorkers want to hear.
Yeah. Well, and that really does. Thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. That really does go to part of the issue when in our political discourse as a whole is that people really care far more about those intangibles than they do your actual knowledge of the policy issues, and they'd much rather have their ears tickled. In other words, you affirm what they already believe rather than be challenged about their ideas. One of the things that I appreciate about guys like Ted Cruz and like Rand Paul is that there are times where I'm not 100% sure that I agree with Rand Paul. But every time I do disagree with him, he's always thought-provoking, he always challenges me, and I have to really sit there and think, do I have the right idea? I appreciate that out of Rand Paul, so that even when we disagree, I have a respect for him. I can't say the same thing for a lot of the liberals in Congress because they don't really push deep, thought-provoking ideas. They push out mantra. And that could be said for a lot of Republicans as well, don't get me wrong. But pushing mantra does not challenge people to really think, and I do appreciate people that make me think. Now, I do want you to remember something about Ms. Cortez here. Remember that she ran on, essentially, the idea that your zip code determines your destiny. I don't know how many times she said that in her campaign, when she was talking to people, when she was giving stump speeches. And it turns out she was lying about her background, because you'll remember that she was painting herself as this underprivileged kid that came out of poverty and squalor and rose to preeminence, went to college, worked hard. And I'm not saying she didn't work hard, but it turns out that that entire story was a lie, because when she was, I think, 4, maybe 5, it was somewhere around that age, she moved from a very, a very poor, impoverished neighborhood to a very affluent neighborhood and had actually a pretty charmed life by any standard. Now, I don't think that that invalidates her ideas, but I do think it shows that she thought, in order to make a better story for herself and ingratiate herself to her electorate, that she thought she needed to have that as part of her story. And if that lie had been true, if she actually had come from a poverty-stricken neighborhood, wouldn't that have completely counteracted her own narrative? Think about it. If she's saying, well, your zip code determines your destiny, and she's just won the Democrat nomination, which means she's pretty much going to win and be a member of the House because she's in New York. If that were the case, and your zip code determined your destiny, and she grew up in a bad neighborhood, wouldn't that mean that it was impossible for her to rise above her circumstances? Look at guys like Ben Carson. Ben Carson comes from a very poor background, and now he is sitting as a member of the White House staff, the head of the Department of Health and Human Services. He's actually in that department. I think he's the head of urban development, or I forget his exact classification, but my point is, guy almost wound up being the nominee for president for the Republican Party. And so it was actually capitalism, ironically, that raised her and her family out of poverty and helped give her those opportunities. I don't believe that your zip code does determine your destiny. And really, if there was ever a case for that being counter to the truth, she is an example of that. And another thing that she brought up in this interview, and we'll get on to something else because there are a couple other issues that I want to touch on. She tried to explain the low unemployment rate right now, because she was saying, well, doesn't your idea of democratic socialism run counter to the idea that now, because we've had about a year and a half of Trump implementing some of his policies, cutting back on regulation, giving tax breaks, that kind of thing, that now there's record low unemployment? And she said, well, the explanation for that is that everyone has two jobs now. Actually, if everyone did have two jobs, that would mean that unemployment would be high. Because when more people have more of something, that lessens the supply of it. So if unemployment is down, that means more people have only one job. Again, she has a degree in economics. I don't understand how she wound up with a degree in economics and in foreign relations when she knows so little about both. Because that's actually exactly what we were seeing with Obamacare. Part of the reason that after Obamacare's implementation that we saw such high unemployment numbers is because companies were scrambling to figure out how they could not have to pay for a person's insurance. And so because of that, they were, and by the way, I personally have some experience with this, they were working them only 29 hours so that they could stay under that 30-hour marker and not have to pay for their insurance. So there were a lot of people, like myself at the time, that had two jobs to try to compensate for that, because they were having to work two jobs because companies refused to make them full-time because of the Obamacare requirement. So back when people did have two jobs, that caused the unemployment rate to rise. It's not that this was, it's not as though this is foreign. It's not as though this is history coming from like 80 years ago. This is a few years ago. And she does not understand the basics of supply and demand economics. She also claimed, I thought this was hilarious, she also claimed in response to that that we had hypercapitalism, which was profit is at any cost. Does she really think we're currently experiencing hypercapitalism? Have you ever tried to open a business in this country? The amount of red tape and regulation you have to go through is insane, especially in her home state of New York. The idea that somehow we have hyper-capitalism when we now have government-run healthcare, government-run Social Security, where everything is top-down, and that we've expanded the Commerce Clause to basically include every monetary transaction that happens in this country. The idea that we have hypercapitalism and everything is profit at any cost is beyond stupid. We're barely capitalism now. We're still the most capitalist nation in the world. Well, actually, there are some reports that say that that's not true, that there's more economic freedom in certain other countries. But we're still more capitalist than most of the world, sure. But the idea that we are currently living in hyper-capitalism, that there's no regulation, is blatantly false. And anybody that has even tried to involve themselves in business transactions and actually run a business, unlike her, in this country will tell you that very quickly. I wish that we did have hyper-capitalism, but the truth is we just don't. And haven't for really about the, I would say the last time we had hyper-capitalism would have been the Roaring Twenties. And there's a reason they're called the Roaring Twenties, because they were the most economically prosperous. That was the most economically prosperous decade and the most innovative decade in American history. So yeah, I wish we did have hyper-capitalism. What this all boils down to, though, is that Ms. Cortez is a very highly educated moron. And unfortunately, this is the case for a lot of millennials. We have lots of degrees, we have lots of education, we're more educated and have more information at our fingertips than any generation, and yet we know nothing. That's what really bothers me. It's kind of like if you've ever read New World Order. Brave New World. If you've ever read A Brave New World, that's really where the idea from all this comes behind. George Orwell, of course, who wrote 1984, his theory was that you were going to have the government banning books, which of course they did, and that was going on in Nazi Germany, and we have examples of that in history. Brave New World takes the opposite approach. His theory was that eventually we would be drowning in so much information that nobody was going to know anything because nobody would bother to read a book, so the government would have no need to ban them because nobody was going to read them anyway. Unfortunately, I think Ms. Cortez is an example of that. 860-1440. We'll be back in just a second.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
John 8:31 and 32. So Jesus was saying to those Jews who had believed him, "If you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free."
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 is the way to get in touch with me if you want to make a comment on the show, comment on what we're talking about. We, of course, always welcome that. You can also tweet me at Tactics Radio. And it looks like Twitter has been pretty quiet this morning. I'm kind of surprised nobody is tweeting about this. But nonetheless, if you do want to tweet me, you want to follow my tweets, get caught up on all the best local and national news, 860-1440, that is the way to do that. Now, there was a speech that was given by our former president, Barack Obama. He was down in South Africa, and there's a lot of stuff going on in South Africa, which I will get to in a second. But he said something that I have to say I found ridiculously ironic, and I will say also that this is part of the reason, maybe not the only reason, but this is part of the reason that unfortunately I've seen a lot of more right-leaning people, a lot of conservatives that have a hard time taking it seriously when there are constant calls of Donald Trump being a liar. Now, Donald Trump is a liar. He's been caught in lies several times. But the reason that a lot of people know that and don't care is because Barack Obama was constantly involved in scandals, constantly said things that were untrue, and the media never called him out on it. I mean, occasionally, I guess. If there were really big lies or there was a really big scandal, they would kind of half-heartedly cover it, but the story still went away pretty quickly. With Donald Trump, every little it's like the media is a bunch of teenage girls. Every little problem that they run into is the biggest problem that has ever faced humanity. And there are people literally saying this. But anyway, so let's go to Barack Obama the other day from South Africa saying this, and you'll understand why there was this, why the right has a really hard time with the double standard of the coverage here. Let's listen to Barack Obama.
We see the utter loss of shame among political leaders where they're caught in a lie and they just double down and they lie some more.
This is a real problem. I agree with the president here. Former president. I mean, you know, you still refer to him as the president, even though he's not the current president of the United States. That's kind of a longstanding tradition here in the United States. But yeah, I agree with Barack Obama. That's a real problem. It makes no sense for people to mindlessly follow somebody who is constantly lying to them just because he happens to be on their political team. Now, I know that Obama would never say something that was untrue just to score political points, and then when he gets caught in the lie, then double down on it.
We will keep this promise to the American people. If you like your doctor, you will be able to keep your doctor. If you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor under the reform proposals that we put forward. If you like your private health insurance plan, you can keep it. If you like the plan you have, you can keep it. If you like the doctor you have, you can keep your doctor too.
Yeah, that was rated the lie of the year by the Washington Post fact checker. Not exactly a conservative news site. And yet, Obama kept doubling down on it. And then when he was caught in the lie and people kept accusing him of lying, he just doubled down on it and kept going. And when people were complaining about their plans being taken away, when he said, if you like your plan, you can keep your plan, he said, well, not those plans. Those plans weren't really covering you. Those plans weren't really giving you everything that you wanted to do. And so really, we know what's better for you as the all-powerful government. We are deciding that those plans are not fit for you and they're dangerous for you to have, so we can get rid of them. But what if I like the plan? Doesn't matter. This is the problem that he has. He knew it was a lie. We know from Jonathan Gruber, who was the architect of Obamacare. He said later, yeah, we knew it was a lie. We knew it was a lie from the very beginning, but we had to get it passed. That's coming out of the mouth of his architect, the person that put Obamacare together. They knew it was a lie then. Obama knew it was a lie when he said it. There was no shame. And then when asked about it, he doubled down, exactly like he just accused our modern politicians of doing. He's right, and he's one of them. But I mean, you know, that's just one example. It's not like I could possibly come up with another example of Obama out and out lying about something that he did or was going to do.
I believe in the Constitution, and I will obey the Constitution of the United States. We're not going to use signing statements as a way of doing an end run around Congress.
I do have an obligation to make sure that I'm following some of the rules. I can't simply ignore laws that are out there. I've got to work to make sure that they are changed.
You know, I'm not a king. I am the head of the executive branch of government.
Each of those statements, by the way, a response to questions about why he doesn't just sign executive amnesty. The man said 22 separate times, oh, I can't do anything about amnesty. I mean, we have a system, we have a Congress. I can't just go around Congress. I'm not a king. I can't just make up laws as I go along. We have a system. The Constitution doesn't allow me to do that. And then when it came time, he said, you know what? Congress isn't doing anything on this. I'm just going to sign it into law. Even though he said to the American people 22 times he could not do it and would not do it because it was not constitutionally allowed, then he went ahead and did it anyway. And so the idea that politicians would just shamelessly lie and say things that they know are not true. Now, to his credit, maybe at that time he didn't know that it wasn't true, or at least he didn't know that he was going to go ahead and do that. But the point is, either way, he completely went against his word, broke his promise not to violate the Constitution, not to try to go around Congress. And of course, he did exactly that with signing DACA as an executive order, which is part of the reason that, as an executive order, the next executive, in this case President Trump, has the power and authority to undo that, which is exactly what should have happened. But I won't get into all that debate. I was just using that as an example to show you that it's hard for conservatives to sit there and take Obama seriously when he says that, when we remember him lying over and over and over and over again to our faces without any consequences or being called out by the media. 860-1440. We'll be back in just a second because there is more to this speech. I think actually the more important part of this speech is coming up in just a second. And I am going to give him a lot of praise for saying this. 860-1440. We'll be right back.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
My hopes of a future life are all founded upon the gospel of Christ. John Quincy Adams.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, that is the way to get in touch with us. You're also welcome, as always, to tweet us at Tactics Radio. We'd love to read some of your tweets on the air. And I'm going to go ahead and play this clip. Let's go to, yeah, I think I've got this one. Okay, this is another clip from Barack Obama in South Africa. And I have to say, I think that this is incredibly appropriate, especially considering what's going on in South Africa right now. For those of you who don't know, South Africa has had a real problem recently with the government actually going into and taking land from white farmers, just specifically white farmers. And they're going in, they're taking land from white farmers and giving the proceeds to black farmers. I mean, it's racial redistribution of wealth, and they're taking it for no other reason than the color of their skin. And when it comes to there being raids, different people sabotaging farms and white businesses, the South African government is doing virtually nothing when it comes to all this. And so I thought actually this statement by President Obama, especially in light of the recent political climate in South Africa, was incredibly appropriate. So I'll give some commentary here in just a second. This is our former president in South Africa.
Now, we're able also to get inside the reality of people who are different than us so we can understand their point of view. Maybe we can change their minds, but maybe they'll change ours. And you can't do it if you insist that those who aren't like you, because they're white or because they're male, that somehow there's no way they can understand what I'm feeling, that somehow they lack standing to speak on certain matters.
Holy cow. That sounds like me. Seriously, that sounds like some of the stuff that I've said here on the radio. That just because you happen to be white and male doesn't mean that the other person can't have empathy for you, that they can't understand what you're feeling, or that they are somehow disqualified to talk on certain issues. Where was that Obama for the past 8 years? I was dumbfounded when I heard that. I mean, in a good way. I'm glad that he's saying that. I was just really surprised because that's not really what we're accustomed to hearing from Barack Obama, but yeah, props to him. All the credit in the world. That's exactly right. I agree with him. I'm not sure exactly why it is all of a sudden now that he is coming out with this idea that maybe it's just not the best idea to just say to certain groups of people, no, you can't possibly understand because you're not X. You can't understand because you're not Hispanic. You can't understand because you're not a woman. You can't understand because you're not black. You can't understand because you're not Asian. Whatever it may be, whatever you're going through saying, well, you can't possibly. I've been saying that for years. In fact, usually when I have a caller that tells me, and I've said this on the air a number of times as well, when they start out the conversation with, well, you can't understand this because you're not whatever it is, that is a person that is not interested in having a conversation. They're interested in yelling at you to make themselves feel better. And the reason that I say that is, if you're coming at it from the angle of you can't understand, then there is no point in you talking to me. Because you don't believe that I can understand no matter what you say, so there's no reason for you to call and talk. There's no reason for you to bring that up in a conversation, because all that is done is it is a tool that is designed to shut down conversation, not make more of it. And I've been saying that for a long time. So I'm surprised that President Barack Obama would come out and say, yeah, this identity politics, not such a great idea. Saying that because you're not a woman, you don't have a right to say anything on abortion, or saying because you're not black, you don't have a right to talk about poverty or schools in bad districts or any of that stuff. Which, by the way, is kind of stereotypical and racist even to say that, which is why I'm using it as an example. But to say those things, that shuts down conversation. It doesn't encourage more of it, and you have no opportunity to change the person's mind, and you don't even believe that you can change their mind if that is the starting point of your discussion. So I 100% concur with Barack Obama. Could not agree more. Again, that sounds exactly like something that I would have said on this program, that I would have said if I were doing one of my many public visits that I go around and talk to people about. That sounds like something that I would utter. So I couldn't agree with him more. Lots of credit to the president on that. That being said, that is not consistent with the way that he would speak when he was president. And I think that, again, that's one of the reasons that it's going to be hard for people to look at this and just accept it and say, yeah, all right, good job, Mr. President, because that is not what he did for the 8 years that he was in office. And to prove my point, here is President Obama saying that to be black means you need to all vote in essentially one block and have one mindset, and you all need to go out and vote for the Democrats. This is in reference to the upcoming election with Hillary Clinton.
We have achieved historic turnout in 2008 and 2012, especially in the African-American community. I will consider it a personal insult, an insult to my legacy, if this community lets down its guard and fails to activate itself in this election. You want to give me a good send-off? Go vote!
President Obama telling people to go out and vote for Hillary Clinton. This was at a Hillary Clinton election event. And saying that essentially, if you want to give me a good send-off as the black community, you guys need to go out and vote for Hillary Clinton. Don't think for yourself. Don't consider voting for somebody else. You need to have a huge turnout and you need to vote this certain way. So, I mean, the guy is the king of identity politics. Keep in mind that the average person, according to a Pew Research poll, thought that race relations were essentially a non-issue around the end of President Bush's presidency, and after 8 years of Obama, it was one of the major issues. I think one of the top three, right after jobs and a couple of other things. They thought that race relations were actually hurt by President Obama's legacy. And with comments like that in the next one we're about to play, it's no wonder why. He said essentially the same thing to Hispanics, that they need to go out and punish the enemies of the Latino community.
If Latinos sit out the election, instead of saying we're going to punish our enemies and we're going to reward our friends who stand with us on issues that are important to us, if they don't see that kind of upsurge in voting in this election, then I think it's going to be harder.
And that's really the problem at the end of this whole thing, is the guy was constantly pushing identity politics all the time. It was the hallmark, really, of his entire presidency, is that identity politics became, I mean, it had almost died out. I wouldn't say that it would have entirely died out, but it had almost died out, and people were pretty much of the mind that race relations were not necessarily settled, but they were certainly in a much better place and were on their way to being etched out entirely. And then President Barack Obama comes in and stirs that fire. Here's another clip that kind of proves my point.
Racism, we are not cured of. It's not just a matter of overt discrimination. We have societies don't overnight completely erase everything that happened 200 to 300 years prior.
Well, and there's nothing wrong with saying that societies don't erase things that happened to 200 or 300 years prior, but he's saying we're not cured of racism. If he's saying that in the sense that there are always going to be racists, then yes, I agree with the president. There's always going to be some portion of the population that is racist. That's a human problem. We've never gotten rid of it in the past. We're never going to get rid of it in the future. And I hate to say that, but that's just the sad state of living in a sinful world. There are always going to be people that hate other people based on the color of their skin. Sometimes people are going to be racist against black people. Some people are going to be racist against white people, so on and so forth. That's always going to be an issue. And so on that front, I agree with him. But the problem is, what he says in that statement is that it's not cured. He continues to stir that pot, and he says overt racism is not just the problem. In other words, even if people aren't actually being discriminated against, if there's some subtle difference that you're noticing in the race, in people of other races, then you're a racist. I mean, this is the guy that wrote in one of his books, I think it was, this one was from Dreams from My Father, that racism is bred into white people. In other words, that it's in their DNA. They can't escape it. White people are always going to be racist because it's part of their genes, which, by the way, is by definition a racist statement. But my point in that is, it's hard for me to understand that Barack Obama is going to be this great healing force when it comes to racial relations, which I always wanted him to be. I was hoping that he would be, and I thought the election of a black man as president, even if he's only half black, but still, a black man as president was going to be go a long way in healing the racial divide and allowing us to put the hurt feelings of racism behind us. And the exact opposite happened. He was constantly stirring that pot and trumping up, no pun intended, when it came to accusations of racism. And that was one of the real problems I had with his entire presidency. So I applaud the president on what he's saying. I hope that that's the new direction that he's going in and he's going to be pushing this going forward. But I would like for him also to come out and admit that maybe he contributed to this a little bit. Maybe there is some fault there. I would appreciate that from the president. I think it would go a long way in conservatives and people on the right like myself being more accepting of this new message as being genuine if he came out and admitted to as much. I kind of doubt that's going to happen. We'll see where it goes. Chaplin's Report is up next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Hebrews 8:10. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, says the Lord, I will put my laws into their minds, and I will write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. I really did not plan this in my story selection today, but I noticed a common theme once I had put everything together, which is if there was ever a theme of the show, I guess you could say, and even though it was accidental, I didn't choose the stories, like I said, specifically to push this idea. But it's funny that the theme of the show really has been reckless words. When it came to President Trump and the things that he said about Russia, it's because I think that he wasn't really thinking before he said a lot of those things. And when he walks it back, it was disingenuous because it seems as though he was not carefully planning out and thinking about his words and how they would be received. I think the same thing could be said in a different way, of course, when it came to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and also with Barack Obama. Words that seem to have double meanings that are inconsistent with things that have been said in the past, and also words that just there's not a lot of thought put into them before they are spoken. And really, the Bible has a lot to say about the way that we communicate with one another. If you think about it, look at John 1:1. For the Word was with God and the Word was God. The name that is given to Christ, the moniker that is given to Jesus in that story is the Word. The salvation of the earth comes from the Word. How did the universe come into existence? God spoke reality into chaos. He created the world through His words. And so communication is something that is infinitely important in the Bible narrative. And Proverbs is no exception to that. It has some great things, some great advice on how to use our communication and our words effectively and in a way that reflects that we are people of God. Let's look at Proverbs 12, 17 through 20. He who speaks truth tells what is right, but a false witness deceit. There is one who speaks rashly, like the thrust of a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. Truthful lips will be established forever, but a lying tongue is only for a moment. Deceit is at the heart of those who devise evil, but counselors of peace have joy. So a lot of really great life advice, and we're just going to go by this piece by piece. First of all, he who speaks truth tells what is right, but a false witness deceit. So what does that imply? First of all, it tells us that there is a right way to use your words and a wrong way to use your words. And one who speaks the truth is doing that which is right. We often try to justify lies or justify at least the idea behind a lie. But the truth is, and this is what the Bible says, one who speaks the truth and tells the truth and is honest with other people, that is somebody who is doing that which is right. So in other words, when you're saying the right thing, when you are essentially acting as an agent of objective truth, you are doing that which is correct, and you are using your words in a manner in which they were intended, in which God gave you the ability to communicate. That's what he gave you the ability to communicate for, to convey truth to other people. All right, verse 18. But there is one who speaks rashly like the thrust of a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. In other words, consider your words. Be wise in your communication and the choices in the words that you make. In doing so, will bring healing to other people. Speaking rashly is like waving a sword around wildly. You never know who it's going to hurt. You're being reckless with your words. You're being reckless with your speech. So you never know who it's going to hurt or who it's going to affect negatively, including yourself. And so he's saying it is much wiser to use your tongue, use your words in such a way that it brings healing and help to other people. Verse 19, where he talks about truthful lips being established forever, but lies only for a moment. Think about some of the great men and women of history. Most of the ones that we look back at fondly are ones that spoke truth. And there's a good reason for that, because truth is eternal. Lies, they have to change all the time. You have to constantly update the lie to make sure it doesn't contradict all the other lies that you've said, and eventually it falls apart. That's why truth always pans out. Lies, they typically wind up collapsing in on each other. And the one who devises evil, that's someone who lies. But counselors of peace, they have joy. If you want to be joyful in your life, be cautious in the way you speak. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com.